This is a lecture by L. Ron Hubbard given on the 15th of October, 1955. The title of this lecture is The Dynamics. This tape is 60 minutes long. Reproduced by Golden Era Productions.
How are you? You realize that changing human being, changing his attitudes for the better, and so forth, is quite an interesting subject. And I want to talk to you about just that. Changing human beings. In view of the fact that nobody has really tried in a positive direction, tried hard and consistently in the past, has tried to change human beings so that they would become much better human beings for themselves and their own benefit, as well as for the benefit of the society, we have then a great deal of newness on this subject. It is a new subject. Now, we have had efforts and activities in the past to change human beings for the benefit of society, and this would be, quote, benefit of society, unquote. We have had efforts on the part of a family to change a human being for the benefit of the family, and again, benefit in quotes. We have had activities on the part of schoolmasters to change human beings for the benefit, and again in quotes, that benefit of the society and the school, and of course the schoolmaster. Now we have had all of these endeavors and activities, and it sounds rather peculiar that anyone would want to come along and change human beings any other way. It's all being done, it's all being cared for. Or is it? There's a singular difference here. We are not aware, although we very well might be mistaken, of any continuous forward effort to change human beings for his own benefit, for the benefit of the schoolmaster, the benefit of the family, the benefit of society, the benefit of the government, and the benefit of Earth. Now that's different, isn't it? That's different. To change a human being for his own benefit without injuring the benefit of the society or the school or the government or man. Now that is different. It's different to just this extent that you cannot change a human being for the benefit of society unless you change him for the benefit of himself. It's a great oddity. There's a thing called the dynamics. A dynamic is an urge toward survival, and there are eight of these dynamics. The first dynamic is the dynamic of self, number one. The second dynamic is the dynamic of future generations. Very constrictedly, it could be called the dynamic of sex, but this would be a very short look at it, since it must perforce include children specifically and must include to some slight degree the family. So therefore, this second dynamic is simply the urge toward survival on the part of the race by the creation of new members of the race and bringing them up and making them into good citizens for the race. And that is the second dynamic. The third dynamic, what we call the third dynamic, is the dynamic of the group. It is the urge toward survival on the part of the group itself and on the part of individuals in that group so that the group itself may survive. And the fourth dynamic is that dynamic of mankind, the urge toward survival of man, for man, by man, and that is the fourth dynamic. Now, immediately here, we are getting just a little bit out of the man in the street's range. He knows himself somewhat. He certainly knows his family. He certainly knows the immediate neighborhood in which he lives, and he's aware of other third dynamic activities, such as his club, his pub, the government. These things, you see, he's aware of. But when we look at him and we say, see here now, there is such a thing as a fourth dynamic, the urge towards survival in you and in others for the survival of man as a species. He'd say, well, it might be. But you know, during the recent war, you know, there were a few fellows around that weren't interested at all in my survival. So we're a little bit out of reach, you see. Something has happened to his fourth dynamic. And that something is the chaos and conflict and hatred and self-interest of war. He has had it proven to him that there is no fourth dynamic. There is no urge toward survival by all men for all man. But that dynamic does exist. Just take my word for it in a moment. Look at it and you see it does exist. There is the fifth dynamic. Survival of life itself, life forms, the urge toward survival on the part of life for anything that is alive. Here we would have animals, vegetables. We would have the dog and the cat and the sheep and the goat and the cow. And here we would have also the wolf and the bear and the dinosaur and any other animal that had ever been alive. All of these would be included in this fifth dynamic, but every one of them has, to some slight degree, an urge toward survival for everything that is alive. Some slight degree. Now we're really getting beyond the average depth, because we know that every time we sit down to a table, something had to die so that we could eat, and we eat and we survive. So therefore, evidently the death of an animal must be and becomes necessary for our own survival. So therefore, we couldn't be surviving if it weren't for the non-survival of the fifth dynamic. See? And this is all very well to say that it's a dog-eat-dog, tooth-and-claw world, and that the spirit of the jungle rules us all, as old past philosophies tried to tell us. You know, it's just dog-eat-dog, and that's the only way there is, and that's what happens. We look along this line of survival of the fifth dynamic, and we have a slight doubt. Unless we can remember as a child being interested in the survival of everything that lived. Now, of course, you did have little children around who occasionally did not realize that flies were alive and picked off their wings. Little boys who grew up to be Hitlers, but they were already crazy. Little children are interested in what's surviving out there. A person with a free mind is also interested in the continual survival of the things out there. He also can look at them and see them kill each other. And he can say, well, they also do that. But unless life did not support life in its activity to live and persevere, there would be no life on this or any other planet. The grass, the lichen, and the moss that break up the soil, the grass that converts the nutrition, are all partners with, incidentally, the chipmunk, and the wild animals in the wood, are all partners in the survival of a tree. And the tree is a partner in the survival of the rest. We have an interwoven picture of the survival of forms here. And each one of those forms has, to some slight degree, an urge toward survival for all forms. Anytime you kill a criminal or a predatory beast and have no feeling when you do so that there might have been something interesting in his life, as we see him lying there, stiffened. But maybe the jungle or the wood has lost something, If we can kill without that feeling, then we are people gone mad. The soldier who can kill without any thought of the enemy on the fourth dynamic, or the hunter who can kill on the fifth dynamic without any thought or regret, is already mad. There is such a thing called the fifth dynamic, the survival of life itself. Well, there's the sixth dynamic. And that sixth dynamic is so automatic, it is so always present, that we just never seem to get around to regarding it as something to survive or to make survive. And that is a physical universe such as this one. And that is the sixth dynamic, the survival of the universe itself. Someone comes along, let us say, and knocks out of existence a planet. He affects us all just to that degree. The death of Earth would be a crime against the sixth dynamic, completely aside from a crime against life. There is a universe here. It is surviving. Its space, its planets, its suns, its asteroids, all these things are perpetuating themselves or being perpetuated through time and are surviving. And every one of us has some small urge to make them keep on going. The seventh dynamic is the survival of the spirit. Now, if you want to regard the survival of the spirit as the survival of ghosts and haunts and demons and leprechauns, go ahead. They all belong in the seventh dynamic. People come along and say, there are no ghosts, there are no haunts, there are no spirits, there is no such influence in any direction at all, because it is scientifically intolerable, because science says so, has gone mad on the seventh dynamic. It has never been proven that spirits do not exist. Never been proven, then why should anyone ever come along and say they do not exist? Maybe they're afraid of them. Maybe they were frightened too thoroughly by Grimm's fairy tales when they were very young. I wouldn't know any other real reason why, quote, science, unquote, should step forward and say, it is a visible world, there is no invisible influence anywhere. I don't know why they'd say this, because it's not true. There are all kinds of interesting influences. In fact, you cannot account for the progress of life generation to generation unless you allow for a spiritual urge and impulse. After a dog dies, what makes a new dog? The materialists say, well, it's all done with genes and chromosomes and hormones and dog biscuit. I was talking to a gene one day he didn't know what he was talking about. There is no mechanical gimmick that could carry along a live form without some sort of live guidance. I have never seen an automobile make another automobile, but I have seen a man make another man. I've never seen two wind-up dolls put in a box, and a few days later, have a bunch of new wind-up dolls march out. But I have seen ants put in a box, and a few days later had more ants than I really cared to do with. And yet the wind-up doll and the ant mechanically are quite similar. We could say, well, there's protoplasm mixed up in it. But let me call your attention that protoplasm is an awfully close cousin to ectoplasm. And if you want to say, well, there's no such thing as a spirit anywhere in the world, that's all right with me. That's your opinion. But I don't like to leave that many unsolved problems lying around when they can simply be solved saying there is a spiritual interest. As it goes along the line, that solves a lot of problems. We stop worrying about it. But there is an urge towards survival of the seventh dynamic. If you don't believe so, I invite you to walk inside a church and look down the altar, and you will see all sorts of images down there. Of course, they're just images, but that's an urge towards survival of a spirit. Somewhere or another, they feel there is a spirit that represents those images. They are not worshiping those images. They are worshiping the spirit those represent. And if those people then told you there was no such thing as a haunt or a spirit or a ghost, I'd say they'd gone mad or were mixed up. Wouldn't you? One of the oldest institutions man has is the worship of spirits, one form or another. Of course, we do not know whether there is or is not a spirit of money, since a lot of men seem to worship that. But I'd say offhand there was more likelihood of the existence of spirits free-flying around and going boo, even that, you know. There's more chance of that being the case than case there were none. In fact, I think it'd be awfully adventurous to say there were no spirits anywhere, being one myself. Now, that's the seventh dynamic, the urge towards survival of the seventh. And as we get up to the eighth, we merely have a bin prepared to hold anything we care to find or do find. It is the dynamic of infinity, and we call it the eighth dynamic simply because it is the symbol infinity turned upright. And then we say that's the eighth dynamic. Somebody comes along and he says, well, that is the creator. That is the creator of this universe. And you say, okay, that's what it is. That's what it is to you. Fine. Good. You have an urge towards survival of the creator of the universe? That's it. Somebody else comes along and says it's something else, and it's actually infinity, the infinity of life and time and everything else. We say, that's fine. That's what it means to you. Go ahead. If we didn't have the eighth standing there, we would have an awful lot of argument about the first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh. We get into any arguments on there, we just throw it into the eighth. Very, very easy thing to do. Well, let me call your attention that our greatest concerns today are with the first, second, third, and fourth dynamics. These are the urges towards survival. First, self. Second, sex, children. Third, group. And fourth, mankind. And these we are intimately concerned with. This is the game we are playing today. Now, the totality of survival in any individual is the ability to survive on any dynamic. And the more dynamics on which he is capable of surviving, the more survival he will accomplish. It's an interesting law, but it is definitely a law. We cannot take an individual and say he is surviving on the first dynamic, but not on the second, not on the third, and not on the fourth, but is doing a fine job of survival on the first dynamic. This is just out. If we had a huge arrow here representing the vector of survival, and we started to segment it into these eight dynamics, we would see that any time we suppressed one of these dynamics in the individual or the group, that we would have suppressed the rest of them. Now there's that old one, do not send to find for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee. You can say the same thing about the dynamics. Don't send to find which one is suppressed. It doesn't matter. If one is suppressed, so will be suppressed the others. They are not independent in their action. They are connected and in confluence one with another. If we take an individual and say, we are going now to suppress him as far as he is concerned himself, that is to say, if we're going to suppress his first dynamic, we're then going to make his third dynamic survive. Oh, no, you don't. You cannot suppress his first dynamic and make his third dynamic survive. It just won't work. Now, when I say it won't work, I am talking out of the most ample bin of evidence that was ever arranged for anyone to inspect, the history of man. When we have selected out of a society a few individuals, and we have crushed their first dynamic in the hopes that we will preserve their third dynamic, and the third dynamic of the society as a whole, we have failed. Every time we pick up some boy out of this society and put him up in front of a court and put him in prison, we are hurting every single part of the third dynamic. And experience will bear that out. We watch this boy. We've done this thing to him. It just works out mechanically. It isn't just because it works out. There's something more here than mere logic. We take this boy. We let him spend the end of his teens in prison. We put him in close association with another third dynamic, all by itself, the third dynamic of the criminal. And when we bring him out, society starts to suffer. And society goes right on suffering, no matter whether we continue to punish him, continue to put him in jail, or kill him. We've hurt some part of the society as a whole. Whenever we have harmed this man's first dynamic, we have hurt all of us. You can look at this practically in a number of ways. It's not that it should be looked at practically, but you can do so. And one of the practical ways to look at this is, very interestingly, there isn't a person in this audience at this moment who has not been cost several pence today because a lot of men are considered too dangerous to have at large and are down here in prisons. And where did they get the money to support these men? Where did they get the food to feed them? Where did they get the machines to care for them in any way, shape, or form? They get them from the rest of the society, from you. Now, when an individual has been so suppressed that he can no longer operate, that individual, from the viewpoint of any given dynamic, is insane. And we have institutions to hold those people. Those people have been so crushed one way or another that they no longer conceive that they can survive. And having so conceived it, they also conceived that they cannot even die. And having conceived this, they are insane. And that is what insanity is. A man is convinced he cannot survive. He is also convinced he cannot succumb. And when he has these two convictions counteropposed, he's mad. That tells you you should be able to scout out what madness is on any dynamic. An insane man, by the way, is not one who successfully commits suicide. That's not an insane man. That's merely a man who has decided to succumb and did so. An insane man is one who may, in a wobbly, wishy-washy sort of way, decide to survive, and then he can't even survive. You know, he can't get the food. He can't match his wits up against the environment. He can't fit himself into his family or his school or his life in general. And he says, I can't survive. And at the same time, because of other factors, he can't succumb either. He can't die. He can't step out of life. He can't extract himself from existence. He has lost the power of choice over his life or over his death. And having lost both of these things, he does some of the more interesting things. He turns on the gas to kill himself, and he leaves the windows wide open. He laboriously procures a knife to slit his throat, only he finds out he's picked up the round, blunt knife sharpener. He takes poison, and he finds out it was aspirin. If you're around insane people very long, you would be struck by the continuance of this sort of an activity. They'll make fits and starts toward survival, and then fits and starts toward death, and then fits and starts toward survival, and they can't make up their minds either way. The insane. These are the insane. They've lost on every dynamic to a point where they can no longer choose to die, to live, nothing. Everything gets sort of automatic and they go on through life. But because they're insane, they can't take care of any one of these dynamics. They cannot stand by and shepherd any one of these dynamics, and they cannot help anybody, another condition of insanity. An insane person can also be defined as one who, besides being unable to survive or succumb, cannot help anything else survive or succumb. And this individual in an institution has a tax and a burden upon the society so great that it could not be calculated. In the environment of this person who has been so suppressed, we discover in turbulence and failure His family is tremendously disturbed. His friends, anything he's connected with, is similarly affected one way or the other. And they delete him out of society to cut down this in turbulence. And he still costs us an enormous toll, like the criminal. The insane person has a burden of pence out of your pockets every day, if we must measure it in money. So totally along practical lines, these things are liabilities in the society. Very definitely, we have the third dynamic, our ability to survive, being suppressed by the fact that these people can't survive. They cannot make their way in existence, and therefore, to some degree, they prevent us from making our way in existence, because all these dynamics are related. If we are interested in playing this game called life, then we cannot escape any of its penalties. Now, life doesn't have a great many penalties to the person who is free and who can help on any dynamic. Let's look at the world situation today, however, and discover that the man on the street is going to have a very hard time conceiving why he should permit the German, the Italian, or the Russian to survive. Why should he permit these people to survive? He said, "I have no interest whatsoever in these areas." Similarly, we might have a hard time convincing the Russian that he has any interest whatsoever in the survival of the Briton or the American or anyone else. He feels he's totally free to do whatever he pleases along any line to suppress the survival of those other third dynamics. He will find out too late, any person who has no attention to that fourth dynamic, he will find out much too late that he shouldn't, ought to have done it. You know why? He'll find that by suppressing the fourth dynamic, that the third dynamic suffers incalculably. In other words, the borders and boundaries which separate men and put them at each other's throats suppress the men as well. We cannot improve a country by waging war against a part of the world. These are important considerations because they are inescapable. Just as nobody won World War II, so nobody, with even a greater exclamation point, will win World War III. Nobody will win it. You can't win a war. They're not winnable. They're only losable. Scientists like to come up to you occasionally and say, "Look, all this scientific spurt and production and all the rest of this thing really took place because we had a war, and therefore war isn't bad." I generally talk to this chap and I find out that he was not standing there holding a piece of steel over his head. He didn't have any gun in his hand. He was sitting in some laboratory someplace figuring about something else. The realities of this thing have escaped him. He won't know the feeling of putting up a rifle or a heavy gun and seeing men die because of the press of that trigger. He won't have this. No, he's going to put it all into mechanics. He's going to prove to you one way or the other that we're going to gain in some way or another because we waged war. Nobody can win. Nobody has ever won a war. We have always only lost them. And why? It's just out of our own framework here in Scientology. It's because you suppress any of the dynamics very thoroughly, and you'll suppress the rest of them. Now, of course, there is such a thing as control and discipline, and you must not at any time get confused about this one fact. There is such a thing as control. There must be such a thing as control and discipline. Did you ever see an acrobat perform a very spectacular feat and see an audience say, "Ah!" Did you ever see anyone perform a spectacular physical feat such as an acrobat? What did it but control and discipline? That's what did it. And the only reason all this talk about freedom has never really won or made any tremendous progress in the world, it's only brought harm, is because people have omitted this other factor, there are two kinds of control, and one control is good and one control is bad. There is nothing wrong with positive control toward gainful goals and the survival of all dynamics. Nothing wrong toward control there at all. And there's everything wrong with control over here toward unknown or unsuspected or upset goals which have no direct command and are kind of unpredicted. In fact, there's been so much of this bad control that we very often think of this word control as meaning only bad control. We think this bad control is the thing, you know. You know, if somebody tries to control me, that necessarily will be bad control. Well, what is bad control? We have a process in Scientology which is called opening procedure of 8C, in which the person being processed is actually commanded directly and forthrightly by his auditor to walk over and touch walls and walk over and touch chairs and to go through exact evolutions just as though he were sort of being marched up and down like a wound up doll. And we could say, well, this is a funny thing. We're trying to make this man free and yet we're marching him up and down like a wound up doll. This is certainly strange. Well, it would seem strange to you if all control seemed to you to be bad control. Quite interesting that this process does a great deal for people. It has an element which is of considerable interest to any one of us, and that is, we say to the fellow, you see that wall? And he says yes. And you say, all right, now walk over to it. And he says yes, and he does. And we say, all right, now touch it. And he does. And we say, all right, now let go of it. And he does. And we don't do this to him. Do you see that wall? Yes. Well, walk over to the chair. No, you're going too fast. I said the table. All right, now touch the table. No, with your other hand. No, not that hand. The other hand. Now, don't touch it with all your fingers. All right, now have you let go of it? You see anything wrong with that? The fellow never gets a chance to complete a cycle of action. He is always left hanging up in an incompleted thing. He is not permitted to do those things which he is ordered to do. Somebody orders him to do something and then they stop him from doing it, or they tell him to do something else before he has a chance to. And if we do that enough to a man, we practically drive him mad. In fact, he'll think he's back in the military. Now, that is bad control. But asking him to walk over to the wall, take a look at the wall, walk over to it, touch it, so forth, each time permitting him to do what we told him to do, brings him up, 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 and he feels better and better, and he feels more alert, and he says, what do you know? I can take orders from somebody without dying in my tracks. And it straightens things out, and he says to himself, you know, I probably can control this body. I can control my beingness and my temper with direct orders. I don't have to be going around in a spin all the time. You know, I can say to myself, now I'm going to walk down to the store and simply go down to the store. I can do that. Up to this time, he was so thoroughly convinced that all control was bad that when he told himself to walk down to the store, the best thing in the world to do was to go to bed. And when he felt himself in bed, to realize he hadn't put out the fire and get up. And when he got up to put out the fire, to decide to read for a little while. Sound like average life? And this individual kind of considered himself aimless in life and without many goals. Now, the proof of anything like this is an interesting thing to follow and observe. But there is a proof like this. There is a process where the individual can be asked who should have controlled him and who shouldn't have controlled him. We'll just paraphrase this process. Who should have and who shouldn't have. And all of a sudden he'll say, my mother.
My mother never told me to do a thing. She never told me to do anything good. She never told me to do anything bad. She didn't control me at all. And at this moment, the individual, as he runs this and so forth, back and forth, spotting places where his mother should have controlled him and didn't and so on, will get the most terrible physical pains over his body anybody ever cared to experience. Here was a little child asking for cooperation in controlling his life, and somebody who should have given him control didn't. Possibly this person had studied somology or other, who said that you should never control little children. You should never tell them to do this or that. You should let them go their own way and mature and grow somehow. They don't mature and grow. They get sick. They're looking to you. They're not able completely to handle themselves in this environment. They're looking for a little positive guidance, you know. Like, Johnny, now you stay on the curb now, all right? You see the traffic? All right, when the traffic all finishes, you walk across the street. They're looking for this sort of thing. They want this sort of thing. They're not happy without this sort of thing. That's a great oddity, isn't it? It's all very well to have self-determinism, but remember, self-determinism exists on eight dynamics. They expect somebody else to take part in this determinism too, and they're not happy unless somebody else does. If they have to give all the orders that are ever given to themselves, they get sick. That's a great oddity, but it can be demonstrated positively in Scientology. Scientific proof exists that this does occur. Now, the clincher on this line is rather sneaky. We get this process called 8C. We get this set up, and here is the auditor, and he is ordering his preclear to walk over to and touch the wall. And he orders him to positively and directly. And the benefit of the process depends on the auditor giving positive, definite, easily understood orders and seeing to it that each one is smoothly carried out without upset to the preclear. Now, you get the idea of what that process is? Get that real well? Now, if you've got that real well, now which one would have run better 8C on you? Your mother or your father? Which one would you rather have run 8C on you? Now, which one of them wouldn't have done a good job of it, really? Got that? Which one of them would have done the poorer job? Now, how about the job the other one would have done? Remember now, the whole process is giving a positive, quiet order and seeing the person carries it out quietly and does just that and never gives another order until that one is carried out. Now, that's a great oddity. You think that over. Some people come to the conclusion that neither one of them would have made very good auditors. Johnny, run down to the tobacconist now. Now, here's a half crown. Now, you get me a package of cigarettes. No. What are you doing there? I said run down to the tobacconist. Well, you're getting on your cap. What are you getting on your cap for? Oh, you're going down to the tobacconist. What am I supposed to do? What did you want? Oh, give you the half crown. Oh, didn't I give you the half crown? I'm sure I did. What have you done with it now? Johnny gets out the door. His mother says, Johnny, come back here. Johnny, as long as you're going down there, why don't you get me a bottle of milk, too? Here we go, see. Confusion. Confusion. Unable to carry through a cycle of action. And that's the average life of a child. You know all you have to do to a child to make them sparking, bright, happy, well? You just run good 8C on them.
good control, that's all. It doesn't matter what you tell them to do, just run good HC on them, that's all. When you give them an order, make sure it's carried out. Now your child is walking around and gloomy and upset. There's a little lower process than that. You don't want them to walk over to the wall. You simply want them to notice there's a wall there. This is about as far as they get, you see? And if you were to say to this little child that's been sort of gimpy and had a cold lately and is kind of upset, and you would just say to this child, "Where's the wall?" And the child will say, "You going nuts or something?" You say, "Come on, come on, come on now, Johnny. Where's the wall?" "What? What wall?" "Johnny, where's the wall?" "Well, it's over there. It's over there. Look, huh? It's over there. Yeah, the wall's over there. What are you asking me for?" "Well, I was just asking you, Johnny. Now, Johnny, where's the floor?" "The floor's right here." "Well, Johnny, where's the chair?" "Well, you're sitting in one." "All right. Now, where's the newspaper?" "There's one right here." Child be perking up, perking up. Just ask him where these things are. It's very interesting. He gets up to a point where he feels bright, and he'll forget all about it, probably, that he had a cold or a headache or something, and go out and play. But if he's had this worked on him very much, and you really run HC on him, you worked up to a point where you could run HC on him, you know, you ask him, "See the wall over there? All right, now walk over to it. Now, don't touch it or attempt to. All right, now touch it. All right, now let go of it. Good. You see that chair? Good. Hey, walk over to it. All right, now touch it. All right, now let go of it. Fine." You know, he sparks right up, he gets brighter and brighter. But a kid who is in fairly good condition will only do this for 4 or 5 minutes. And then you know what he'll do? He'll say, "All right, now it's your turn." And you better let him, too. Believe me, I've walked over and touched more walls for more kids. Now, if you run this "where is" process too long, they'll start flipping that one on you, too. They'll start asking you, "Well, where's the table?" So, well, you better answer them. They're in better shape than most adults. But now, do you see that you could do almost anything with this child, really, from a standpoint of discipline? As long as it was really discipline and not punishment and not duress. How far do you think an auditor would get in making a pre-clear well if the auditor ran HC this way? "Do you see that wall?" "Well, if you don't walk over to it..." Get the idea? There's no life in there. There's just a bunch of misemotion. And so we get these difficulties very plain to the eye. We have him complete the action before he starts another action. Therefore, discipline to a child would be rather easy. It's an odd thing, but you know, some of these very bad children, they're always tearing everything up and so forth, are usually being run by very bad auditors. I guess Mom and Papa wouldn't think of themselves as auditors, but that's all they are, just bad auditors. They don't operate on the auditor's code. They do all sorts of things. And do you know that the totality of control is only possible in some such framework as the auditor's code? That's a code of how to be civilized. It's also a code of how to get things done. Now, you think that if you're a corporal of a squad or a general of a company, I don't know, a general of a private, that's about as much as most generals can command. You think that it's absolutely necessary to have punishment and prisons and all kinds of things that you can throw your men into in case they don't do just exactly what you say. That's because when they were being trained, somebody was in too much of a hurry. They didn't run good HC on them. And generals run very bad HC on most armies. And then they say, "Why don't they obey?" They don't obey because they don't know how to obey. That's a very, very interesting thing, that the army is no good unless it is obeying a good auditor in the general. It's just no good, that's all. So, how do you control people? All you got to be is a good auditor. You don't have to restrict and restrain yourself all the time and never feel sad or tired or worried. But if you feel sad or tired or worried and you start yelling at Johnny, for golly sakes, don't tell him that the reason you're yelling at him is because he's a bad boy. Tell him you're yelling at him because you're in a bad temper. If you played this auditing game with him very much, he'd probably turn around and audit you. You never saw such avid auditors as little kids. I've seen 6-year-old children run engrams out of pre-clears, their mothers or aunts or something like this, with great efficiency and effectiveness. First time I ever noticed this happen, a young boy came down to breakfast. And there was his aunt, about 50, sitting at the table, badly hungover. She'd been out with the girls the night before. And this little boy came down. He was a very sober-faced, dignified little boy, but a very pleasant one. Pretty harum-scarum, too, at times, you know. But he walked in and he took one look at his aunt, sort of like, can this be real? You know, he says, what's the matter with you, auntie? And his aunt says, hush, go away. Oh, he says, no, he says, take it easy. Is there something really wrong with you? And she says, I feel terrible. And he says, well, all right, what were you doing last night? And I was sitting at the other end of the kitchen drinking a cup of coffee, and neither one of them saw me. She knew I was there as much as she knew anything. But he hadn't noticed me. So he said, well now, Annie, back in old Dianetic times, return to the moment you took your first drink last night. And she says, all right, I'm there. He says, now tell me everything that happened right from there right on up to present time. He made her run it over 5 separate times perfectly, had it all erased, smoothed out. She was in good shape. He says, now are you in present time? And she said, yes, I am. Thank you, Johnny. He says, well, that's all right, but now get me some breakfast. We have a 12-year-old professional auditor in the States, and I was kidding her about her rates. They were 50 cents an hour. It's not very much money. I was kidding her about these. So she heaved a sigh of relief at the thought that maybe she didn't have to charge that little to get pre-clears, and she charged 75 cents an hour. Something on the order of about 8 bob. And charging 75 cents an hour, she doubled her practice, and it was overworking her, so she said, I'll get rid of this. I'll charge $2 an hour. About 16 shillings or about. She increased her practice. She came around to see me. She says, Ron, where does this stop? She said, I've stopped auditing kids. I'm only auditing adults now. And I said, you drop it back to 2 bits an hour, you'll be all right. And she did. She was auditing all of her schoolmates. Her teacher was very mystified because the whole class started to get brighter and brighter, and the teacher got prouder and prouder, you know, of what a good job she was doing. And it all went along all right until this little girl started auditing the teacher. And the teacher thought something very suspicious was going on here. But in view of the fact it was just a children's game, she would go along and play it. And she went through about 45 minutes of 8C before she found out that the little girl was not playing a game. The little girl explained to her that all of her children had gotten so bright that she too ought to be willing to be more able. About 2 hours of processing from then, the teacher was no longer recalcitrant as a preacher. Quite interesting. 12-year-old kid can do this sort of thing. She, by the way, has a certificate. She'd gone all the way through school, everything. Her mother had been in Scientology for some time. She turned up one day and she says, "I want to enroll in class." She had received a little money and she thought that she could possibly bum her way in with this. And I said, "Well, now, if you actually want to attend class, I'll just enroll you. There's no charge here." So I wondered how she'd get along. And she made the best grade in her whole class. Now has her certificate and so forth. Legally, of course, she probably won't be able to practice as a full... I suppose they could get her right now for child labor or something. Hey, you realize they could probably throw that auditor in jail? Well, that's all right. She'd audit the warden. She's an eager beaver. Well, anyway, you get the idea between good and bad control. You get the idea between these two things? Bad control is indecisive, goalless unknowingness with rancor or anything else. See, but it's just goalless. It has no real intention. The end of the control is not to get anywhere. Both parties involved are not agreed on the fact that control should take place. There's a disagreement there. It's done without any knowledge of finishing an action being necessary to good life. And so it can get very confused and very upset. Bad control can. But good control only leads upwards. Now that's an oddity, isn't it? No control at all is bad control. Just no control at all is bad control. But if control is carried out as an auditor would run a preclear, orderly, some attention to being civilized, with talking about it, getting an agreement on why we're trying to do this thing, then it results in resurgence. So we can say the trouble with the human race is there's been too little good control and too darn much bad control. Look at the same data now on the fourth dynamic. The fourth dynamic. Where do we have any control on the fourth dynamic? Of course, we can have some huge nation overpowering some small state. That's not good control. We don't have nations turning to and running nations. And this is a funny thing. We got together a thing called the United Nations. And that's an interesting organization. It has very fine goals. It's very idealistic. There's nothing wrong with the United Nations except it has no power at all. It's not then a control factor as far as the world is concerned, is it? We have in Scientology what we call colloquially a camouflaged hole. You know, somebody's supposed to be there and there's a body there, but nothing's happening. See? Somebody's supposed to be doing this and that, and certain duties are supposed to be attended to by this person, but nothing is happening. We call this a camouflaged hole. Now, the United Nations is kind of a camouflaged hole, isn't it? People say, well, there's somebody doing something one way or the other, and it's all sitting there. But actually, the United Nations didn't prevent even the Korean War, that unpopular fiasco that need never have occurred. There have been several wars since the United Nations was formed to prevent war. Well, if they're just formed to prevent war, they can't prevent war. Why? Because insanity results from no control. That's why. If you don't take any control of anything at all, you're going to be connected with it in any way, shape, or form. The only thing that can result is more insanity. We have a camouflaged hole in the United Nations. If the United Nations at any time would be willing to take some responsibility in regulating the course of nations with relationship to each other, trade, commerce, finance, something along in this line, we would see an improvement of this situation. Now, I'm not beating the drum for the United Nations or against the United Nations. It has nothing to do with it. I'm just giving you a demonstration. Here's this fourth dynamic sitting here. It hasn't got any control factor. Now, men try to establish a control factor sometimes by creating a new religion. They create a new religion by extincting and throwing into yesterday the beliefs of others. You're not going to create any good control that way. You know, let's all have a worldwide religion now. See, bing, bing, let's have this religion, and we're going to control everybody, and therefore we'll all be under good control. And if you don't believe in this, we're going to shoot you. We've done this before, you know. We've had this sort of movement start up one way or the other. They're not successful because they think to succeed, that all they can do is kill people or knock somebody off or crush the beliefs or activities of others. And so we get into a conflict here as long as we don't all speak the same language. We're going to have difficulty giving orders to one another or understanding what everybody is all about and so forth. You get the idea? I mean, there's liable to be an turbulence there. But at the same time, this isn't an adequate reason to believe that we could not evolve out of all these societies of man a good, forward-looking, workable control mechanism to take care of the fourth dynamic so these nations wouldn't be flying at the throats of these nations. There's no reason to suppose we couldn't do this if it were intelligently approached. Because let me assure you, that control depends on good, intelligent approach. Now, it's no business of ours to form an international government. No business at all. But it might be some of our business to get a jack under some of these boys that are and process them enough so they come up in IQ enough so they'll be smart enough to form one. Get the idea? That's the way you go about that. Now, it's very possible that an international government isn't the answer. Supposing man at large just said, you know, this is silly, nations fighting nations. Why, we're just not going to do it anymore. There's another answer, isn't there, of sorts. You know, Ben said, well, you know, it's real silly. It never worked out. All of a sudden, some Hitlerian Schickelgruber comes rising on the scene, and he says, down with them verdammt Englanders, down with them verdammt Americaners. Kick them all in the teeth. His people will say, who? Who, them? Oh, you must be mistaken. They're all right.
Be an interesting reaction, wouldn't it?
Well, do you know that that is the same reaction of people to war? Who then makes war possible? And who then wipes out this fourth dynamic? It's the state that with bad 8C makes the criminal, because a Hitler can only come to power if he already has a degenerated third dynamic which contains criminal elements. And he can use those criminal elements to force the decent, intelligent people of his nation to force other nations into conflict. And that's the way the trick is done. Do you see that? Gradually, we suppress dynamic after dynamic. Pretty soon, some fellow has a third dynamic which is real flat. Enough people have been thrown in jail, enough insane are in those hospitals, so that somebody can rise up and he's got a huge population already to draw on. And he can say, kill everybody. And an enormous criminal population in the country can say, all right, kill everybody. Because intelligent and decent people don't do this and won't agree to this. So it looks to me like the solution on the fourth dynamic lies in a lot of solutions on the third. And the solution on the third lies to an awful lot of solutions on the first. We can process an awful lot of people today. One of the things we'll have to do inevitably is bring those jails up to a point where their people can be trusted with decent people. We can raise their first dynamic to a point where they can have a third dynamic. And when we've done that and accomplished that, and when we've taken the people in the society who are suppressed into slavery, completely aside from these criminals, when we've taken people in the society who's under economic duress and inability to get along and so forth are entirely and continually in conflict, we will then lift off the back of the neck of society perhaps a little bit the necessity for a tremendously arduous suppression. And when that necessity is gone, we'll find there are an awful lot of reasonable people that look around and say, hey, you know, we've got a good nation.
And if they've said we've got a good nation, you know what they're liable to say now? There isn't any reason to go to war with other nations. Let's see if we can't give them a hand. And when they've said that thing, there'll be no more war. And it all starts here with the first dynamic, raising it and raising all the others in turn. That's the best solution I know at the moment to the thing called the atom bomb and to the fate of man. Thank you.